here. You are sitting in a Women in Baseball panel. So welcome, everybody. This is going to be a really fun session, guaranteed. So sit back, relax. We're going to have an open dialogue, open discussion about all things women in baseball related. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Ann Carroll. I am based here in Minneapolis with Fox Sports North, covering Minnesota sports. Primarily, I cover the Minnesota Vikings on a regular basis, but I've covered the Twins as well since 2006, along with the NHL's Minnesota Wild, the University of Minnesota, and basically anything to do with sports here in Minnesota. I am a Minnesota native, born and raised in Minnesota. I have been with Fox Sports North since 2006. This is my dream job. I worked hard to get back to my hometown to cover my hometown team. So it's been pure joy to be back in Minnesota to work in television and work in sports. I feel very, very lucky to have done so. So an honor, too, to come here today and talk about baseball. A little bit about my baseball background. I have been in television sports since I graduated from college. I knew what I wanted to do growing up. I grew up in a family of all boys. I am child number 7 after 6 boys. So mom and dad had time for a girl. So you can imagine, now that I have kids of my own, I can't even imagine they kept trying. But they kept trying, and I'm the extra point on the touchdown, as they say. Football reference. But I knew I always wanted to be in sports. I grew up around the game. I grew up around football, baseball, and hockey growing up here in Minnesota. So I knew that I wanted to be around sports, and the media seemed like a pretty great fit. So I got a journalism degree, got my first job in northern Minnesota, in Duluth, Minnesota. Anybody been to Duluth, Minnesota? You know where Duluth is. They're kind of going through tough times right now with a lot of water up there, but we love Duluth, and we know, pertaining to this panel, the history of the Duluth Dukes and women in baseball. So I can attest to a little bit about that. Covered the Twins briefly for my first stint in Minnesota, Minneapolis. Went on to cover the Kansas City Royals in Kansas City for the Fox affiliate there in the Tony Muser era, in the Mike Sweeney era. It was Carlos Beltran's rookie season. Jermaine Dye, to this day, still one of my all-time favorite players to cover. Enjoyed my time at Kauffman Stadium. One of the best in baseball, you have to agree. But I kind of pulled a controversial move after 4 years in Kansas City. I went across I-70, and I went to St. Louis, and I went to a real baseball town. And if you have ever spent time in St. Louis, you know what that franchise means to that city. I came from a football town, primarily Kansas City, at that time, and went over and really went to a baseball diehard city, and got my fill of Cardinal baseball history from the get-go. I enjoyed learning the history of Cardinal baseball and had the pleasure to interview many times Stan Musial. I took a pitch from Bob Gibson at one time, and I hit it too. I had a fabulous time going to Legends Camp in Jupiter, Florida with some of the best baseball people ever. And if you've ever done anything like that, you know how much fun a fantasy camp can be as a fan, and even as a professional, just to be that up close and personal to a franchise and to some of our favorite players of all time. And so after years in St. Louis, then I was led back here to Minnesota. So that's a little bit about me, and I can kind of provide some media insight. What's it like being a woman in the locker room, covering these players on a daily basis? Covering baseball is a lot different than covering the NFL, but a lot different than covering the NHL and college sports. The amateur athlete is a lot different than covering the professional athlete. So that's kind of what I bring to the table, and want everybody to kind of just enjoy today. This is an open forum. There's a microphone set up over there, and I can kind of dash to it if need be to grab your question and just kind of have a fun, open dialogue with our panel. So let's get on to the panel here. First off, joining us, please welcome, well, we'll start right here with Cecilia. This is Cecilia Tan, and many of you are familiar with Cecilia. So let me read a little bit about Cecilia for those of you that may not be familiar with Cecilia. Cecilia is Sabre's publications editor since 2011. She's been involved in baseball in one way or another since she fell in love with the sport with the 1976 New York Yankees. She writes the oldest baseball blog on the internet, Why I Like Baseball. And she played second base in right field with Pawtucket Slaterettes. That's the oldest continuously operating all-female baseball league in the country. She's currently serving as publications editor for Saber, and this past winter was the co-editor of the Baseball Prospectus Annual. Impressive. Please welcome Cecilia.
You said you made some opening remarks, and now I can't think what I was going to say. Other than I'm really glad to see that you are all here, and to say that I've seen a lot of changes in the years that I've been in baseball. Some of you know I also wrote a couple of books about the New York Yankees. I wrote one about the Red Sox. I've spent some time in the clubhouse interviewing current and former players, and have been around the game for quite a while as a freelance writer. And I see, over the last 10 years especially, I see more and more women covering baseball in the clubhouses. I see more women in the press box. I see more women here at this convention than there were 10 years ago. And not just spouses and daughters, although I am often mistaken for one or the other. Well, maybe not so much now that you guys have been seeing me for 10 years, you know me. But it just continues to grow. And I think the more women you see, the more acceptance of women in all aspects of the sport, in front offices, and so on, you're going to see. And that's a trend that's not going to slow down anytime soon.
Well, we will discuss next on our esteemed panel. Please welcome Dorothy Seymour Mills. Pretty smashing today. Now, Dorothy has written 26 books. She is a pioneer among baseball historians. With her late husband, Dr. Harold Seymour, she co-authored the classic three-book series called Baseball, published by Oxford University Press. In 2010, the couple was selected as part of the inaugural class of recipients of Saber's Henry Chadwick Award, which honors the game's greatest researchers, historians, statisticians, analysts, and archivists. She's also authored a woman's work, Writing Baseball History with Harold Seymour, which revealed her contributions to the baseball series. After not receiving credit for her work for many decades, Dorothy was finally listed as a co-author when the book was re-released in 2010. Her most recent books are Chasing Baseball, Our Obsession with Its History, Numbers, People, and Places, and Drawing Card, A Baseball Novel. She's a pretty good person to have on this panel. Please welcome Dorothy.
I've been working in baseball history for about 60 years now, ever since I began working with my late husband and took over the job that we were working on together. And since then, I've been working on my own. I enjoy writing very much, and baseball history has always fascinated me, but I gradually began to focus more and more on amateur baseball, and especially on women's baseball, when I could see how the women's baseball picture fit into the general history about women in this country. So I've been focusing lately on writing books about women's baseball history, and I hope to tell you a little about that today. Thank you.
Well, we're right here in Minnesota with the Minnesota Twins. Please welcome our next panelist. This is Laura Day. Hi, Laura. Now, Laura is the Executive Vice President of Business Development for the Minnesota Twins. She has served in that spot since 2006. She oversees the team's revenue generation, including ticket sales and corporate partnerships, and played a key role in the Twins transition from the Metrodome to Target Field in 2010. Now, prior to joining the Twins, she worked at the Minneapolis Convention and Visitors Association and served as Vice President of Sales for Victory Sports One. She was one of the first employees of the Minnesota Wild Hockey Team of the NHL, helping to launch the XL Energy Center as Vice President of Corporate Partnerships from 1999 to 2002. Laura got her start in sports working for the Twins from 1991 to 1999, where she held a variety of posts, including Vice President of Sales and Marketing, Director of Corporate Marketing, and Promotions Manager. Welcome, Laura Day.
It is to be here today and to be sitting with such a group of esteemed women who I think the really underlying common denominator of these wonderful women here is a love of the game. And it's exciting to be a part of this. I feel a little sheepish, actually, especially sitting next to Dorothy, author, teachers, players, writers, broadcasters, and then me. I just know. Lots of tickets, lots of partnerships. Anyways, again, really, really a pleasure to be here today with you, and thanks for taking the time. Although, I had to tell Leslie, I said, I'm looking at your conference schedule, and they don't even allow you lunch breaks. That's what I had a long day, my goodness gracious. I've had the good fortune of having been born and raised in Minnesota. I must be doing something right. I haven't gotten the boot yet. I guess my claim to fame is I've worked for 3 of the 4 pro teams in town. The Minnesota Twins, obviously. This is my 3rd time back with the organization. The Minnesota Wild, I was their 6th employee hired back when we were trying to bring the hockey franchise back, which I think we did so quite well. I will be honest, they didn't hire me for my hockey acumen. More so the business side. Although I did learn how to ice skate on CCM hockey skates. And then I did a short stint with the Minnesota Vikings back in the era when Red McCombs owned the team for a short period of time. So I have had some interesting background. I will tell you, I have come back for my 3rd time to really the sport that I truly love the most, which is baseball. And I know you, I think, had a session this morning with one of our great leaders in the game of sport, Dave St. Peter, our president, who is my boss at the Twins. I think Terry Ryan is going to spend some time with you. Clyde Dechner, how many show of hands had a tour of Target Field? Fantastic. I want to call out Kristen. You could stand and give away. One of our spectacular tour guides. A very good Twins employee. Little known, she too was a professor at an esteemed college here locally in the Twin City area. And I really attribute the fact that we have a very established tour program and specifically educational curriculum developed in large part to the efforts of Kristen and some of her colleagues at Target Field. If you haven't had a chance to get over and take that tour, highly recommend it and ask for her because she's the best tour. But she also has a tribute to women in this game that we love. Does a great job on a tour, specifically around women in baseball. So, glad to see that she's in the audience today. But looking forward to answering questions and telling you, I think, a little bit more about our varied backgrounds here on the panel this afternoon.
Yeah, we got a lot of fun things to talk about. And then last but certainly not least, on the end over there, please welcome Leslie Heapy. Did I say that right? She's a member of Sabres since 1989 and chair of Sabres Women in Baseball Committee since 1995. She was elected to the Sabre Board of Directors in 2010. She is an associate professor of history at Kent State University at Stark and publishes in the area of Negro Leagues baseball and women's baseball as well. In 2008, she became the founding editor of the journal Black Ball, published by McFarland Publishing. She lives in Kent, Ohio. Welcome to Minnesota.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to see so many of you here. It's a wonderful chance to talk about something that we all love in maybe a context that we're not necessarily all quite as familiar with. It's a fascinating story to look at historically, since I'm a historian, that's what I intend to do, is to be interested in where things came from, where it started, and so this opportunity to take a look at that aspect of the game is what fascinates me. And I have to admit, Growing up, I live in Ohio now, but I'm actually a New Yorker, but I'm not a Yankees fan. I happen to be a Mets fan, and so, thank you. did, and actually never really thought about the idea that women couldn't play baseball. It never occurred to me that that it wasn't something that women weren't expected to do, that you were supposed to play softball. And I never actually played, except with my dad and my brothers in the backyard. Reading about it, began to realize, wow, there's a story missing here. Not finding anything. And my real interest developed between the combination of women's baseball and the Negro Leagues, because I discovered in my Negro League research there was this fascinating connection between women and baseball, because there are more women who have played at that level than have played at any other higher level. That's the connection for me between the two of those ideas. And I see some of you nodding your heads. The name Tony Stone is probably the most familiar name to most everybody in that connection. And so that's where my two interests come together, in that opportunity. And then I get the grand chance to teach about it on a pretty regular basis. And much like Cecilia said earlier, it's been an interesting evolution to watch. I've been at Kent for 18 years of teaching and watching the change in my students coming to those classes from entirely male when I started to almost 70% female now in my sports history and baseball classes over that time period, which has been an interesting change to watch and see. So, thanks for being here.
Thank you all for being here. Not everyone is familiar with how they got to where they are. And I think when we hear about the term, we hear women in baseball, well, do women play today? We think of a league of their own as far as that represents what women's baseball is all about. But so I think our discussion can go toward where women in baseball is today. But I want to just maybe take us some time to kind of introduce now our panel and understand how they got to where they are, why they are here with us today, kind of where their passion lies, and then simply just open it up, because as they have shared a little bit about their background, I'm sure some questions have popped into your head about things that you are interested in. And same with those of us on the panel. But I think, first of all, I'm just interested to know from Dorothy, where did your baseball fascination come from? Was it as a little girl growing up? Was it, a family influence? Or where did someone, with your wisdom and knowledge, where did the baseball passion come from?
My late husband. He was the first historian of baseball, the first historian ever to write standard baseball history. And I worked with him because I was interested in such an unusual topic. And I gradually took over the project because I was an English major and I'm crazy about research and writing. And we worked together very well. And as he went through the project, at the end, when he became sick, I took over everything, writing and all. And after he passed on, I continued my interest. He was much more interested in the majors. He saw amateurism and minors and all that as a progress up until the majors. And when we got to write about the majors, and that's the only thing he was interested in. He lost his interest in the amateurs, whereas that's really where my interest lies, because I have a more sociological bent in my interest. So after he passed on, I thought I was finished with baseball, because I had worked at it what seemed like all my life. Then I got back into it on the women's side, and I was asked to write my autobiography. I published that in 2004 with McFarland. And from then I began to get more and more ideas about baseball and women. I had a large section about women's baseball in my next book called Chasing Baseball, in which I tell about the obsession of fans, because I wanted to show how different women's interests are in baseball. They act like regular fans, but they also have a problem in that if they play it the way the men do, whenever they want to, they have breaks on their play, and they have to stop at a certain point, and they can't look forward ever to playing in the minor leagues or the majors. And after that, I went on to write my latest book, which is called Drawing Card. I'd like to tell you a little about drawing card and why I wrote it. It's an historical novel, not historical novels before, but not about baseball. This book gave me the opportunity to put together my interest in writing historical novels and my interest in baseball. I got the idea because when thinking about women's baseball history, I realized there were at least three women who were actually signed to minor league contracts, but they never got a chance to play in minor league baseball. How did that happen? Well, the same thing as happens in other aspects of women's lives. They were rejected before they had a chance to show what they could do. The first one, in 1931, a woman was signed to a minor league contract, and a picture was taken in the town uniform at the fall, and they put in the paper, and the manager announced she'd be there in the spring. The spring, she had disappeared. She was not in the line. The newspaper men decided that she must have been canceled by, her contract must have been canceled by the commissioner. Nobody said really what happened. That same year, another woman, same thing happened to her. But this time, the commissioner admitted that he had canceled her contract just simply because she was a woman. The third one, that happened in 1952, this woman was also signed. She got to practice with the team for a while. When they went off, she never played a game on the field, and when they went off, the team went off to play play a club in another city. She wasn't with it. And this time, there was not only a letter from the commissioner, but a threat that if anybody else signed a woman, there would be consequences. There would be fined. So I began to think about this. How did those women just disappear? How did they do something about it? Because it was a different era. We were raised differently. These people were doing what they were taught to do. They were taught to be quiet, go home, politely, don't say a word, and do something else. And that's what women did in those days. I know, having been born in 1928, we were taught not to object when we were discriminated against. That gave me an idea for a novel. What if there were a woman who did object and made a big fuss about it? What if she was a person who let this rankle in her until she decided to do something really dangerous and foolish? What if she decided to murder the commissioner? In ways that maybe that were not legal, for example, following the mafia. But this had become part of their personality, fighting against those who try to overcome them. So I decided to that this would give me the opportunity not only to show what this woman might have done, but also to show what other women in baseball history and in athletic history have done. I gave her ancestors who were also as truculent as I made her, so that I could show you what had happened to other women in athletic history, women's athletic history, for example, when the Greeks took over. So I had a lot of fun writing this book, and it's a serious book. It sounds hilarious when I tell you she's thinking of murdering the commissioner. But believe me, it's serious. And after all, there are a lot of women who have grown out of that business of being quiet all the time. She grew out of it earlier than men did. So I have to find it interesting to look up Drawing Card, a baseball novel, just published by McFarland.
We got some reading to do, people. All right. Well, let's take a little trip. trip to baseball front office, shall we, with Laura, and find out what it's like on a day-to-day basis to work for a franchise that has been here in Minnesota since 1961. Based now, I say, because of my time with the Vikings, this is a football town, but in the summer, of course, we are all about our Minnesota Twins, and we have two World Series to be proud of here in Minnesota. Laura, first maybe a little background on your passion for baseball. Growing up here in Minnesota, your memories of watching the Twins in the early days, was it the Twins that struck a chord with you, or what was it for you?
Well, I was born the year that the Twins moved from Washington to Minnesota, so okay, I'm a nifty-fifty for those of you who are doing the math. And, you know, it was interesting. I think the baseball DNA I have, I think I garnered from my mother. She grew up in Grand Forks, North Dakota. She told me that she probably made a mistake along the way. At one point, she had a blind date. She and a girlfriend went out with two young gentlemen, one of which was Hank Aaron. And it's been kind of fun because my mom and I have traveled to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where there's a great little ballpark called Carson Park in Wisconsinites here in the...
Actually, Fox Sports broadcast there.
Carson Park, yeah. We got the bust of Hank Aaron there when he played for, I believe, the Milwaukee Braves. So anyways, I'm not sure that's where I got my love of baseball, but anyways, my mom was very avid baseball fan, and I think my dad kind of tagged along and then grew to love the game as well. But I remember as a small child, it's kind of funny, do you remember those round baseball-looking transistor radios?
Yes.
That had the silver little chain and the hook on the end? So I, you know, at night, of course, mom would say, time to go to bed, I'd have a little round transistor radio underneath my bed. And I turn on that game, and I just listen to Twins baseball till the wee hours of the night. Needless to say, I never in my wildest dreams thought I would ever go to work for a baseball team. I knew nothing about the baseball business when I got into it. My background, again, born and raised here, went to school here, worked in the financial industry as a stockbroker, of all things, kind of weird. And then made a bit of a change, went to work for an advertising agency, and had a chance to do some work with Major League Baseball on a big promotional program for General Mills, which was one of my clients at the time. And a friend of mine, Rosemary, happened to be down at the old Metrodome buying tickets for a baseball game, and she called me and said, you have got, this is before cell phones, before computers, you know, we were typing on IBM Selectrics. She said to me, there's a job opening at the Minnesota Twins for a promotions position, and you would be perfect. And I'm like, what? I have no idea about running of a baseball team. I played softball for many, many years recreationally. I wasn't very good. I was a pitcher. Why, I'm not sure, but love, you know, I just loved being as close to the sport as I could get. And needless to say, I typed up a whole presentation on an IBM Selectric. Thank God for whiteout tape with those days. I got the job. And at the time, Jerry Bell was our president. It was 1991. It was a great year to start at the Minnesota Twins, for those of you that remember. I would still say, and I will admit I'm biased to the day as long, the best World Series yet. At least in my history with the game. Anyways, long story short, got the job, and have loved every minute of it since. I feel very blessed to have worked with a group of people that are as committed and passionate about not just the game, but the business of sport, and are as passionate about our fans, and our fan engagement, and our players, and our community, because without our community and our fans, we have no baseball team. And we never forget that, never take that for granted. But, so I was there until about 1998, give or take, and lived through those dark days of the late 90s, post-strike in 1994, cutback staff, you know, it was just those were some dark days in the game. And did a quick cup of coffee with the Vikings, realized in a big hurry I had made an egregious mistake, and then went to the Wild for 4 years, came back to try and launch a regional sports network, which at the time, we were operating, with a less than market rate broadcast arrangement with the old Midwest Sports Channel, if you remember what that used to be. Now it's Fox Sports North. And we thought that from the team perspective, because we did own our broadcast rights, that perhaps we could start our own regional sports network. We did not succeed in that. We ultimately ended up with a great relationship with what we now know today as Fox Sports North, Anne's group of folks that she works with. So I closed that company, which was interesting. I'm not a closer, I'm a builder. Went off and did some other things. Came back in 2006 when the legislature finally approved the ballpark and the financing package. We are blessed with great ownership. I will tell you, certainly having worked for Carl in the 90s and now working for Jim and Bill and Bob, kind of that next generation of team ownership, they are as committed to this game and Target Field and our fans throughout Twins territory as anyone. It's funny when I think about it, I tell this story that in the Metrodome, it was a tough place to play baseball. We played in the corner of the ball, a football stadium. We were an afterthought. There were 6,000 seats between first and third base and the lower deck that were really probably the best seats in the house for baseball. And they still weren't very good. I hate to say it was a great one. We won 2 World Series there. I can't complain. But when we had the chance and the opportunity, obviously, to move into Target Field after a very long and lengthy, drawn-out, sometimes very difficult process of getting our ballpark approved, and fortunately, we had owners that were committed to staying through that process, we opened what I think, and again, I'm very biased, I'm not shy, I think is the best ballpark in the country. It was not only me who was saying that, I think it was voted by fans across the country as part of an ESPN poll to have the best fan experience. Leslie will correct me if I'm wrong, back in 2011. And we were one of the first facilities of our kind to get LEED certification, which of course is important from an operations and maintenance perspective in maintaining that environmental stewardship that is so important to all of us today.
And I know many of you have not had the opportunity to go to Target Field. It is part of your experience here in Minnesota. But I think what you will find that is so important, and not all ballparks do this, and I think from the model that Target Field has set, ballparks from now on will set a standard in honoring the baseball history, not only at the major league level, but also as we see at Target Field, you'll just love learning about from town baseball to other history. And I think that had to have been an important aspect when this ballpark was built, that the history would be reflected from Harvey Killebrew to town baseball to Kirby Puckett to those World Series to everything that you experience at Target Field. It's more than going to that, to the game, isn't it?
It is, and again, I credit Dave St. Peter with having the vision, if you will, to really embody the legacy and the tradition and the heritage, the rich heritage we have from a baseball perspective in this marketplace. I very blessed with tremendous players throughout the course of the years. Of course, Harmon Killebrew, one of my all-time favorites. Rod Carew is still with us today, very much an ambassador for our franchise and our club. Spends a lot of time back here in Minnesota working with us and our fans. Tony Oliva, all of those just marvelous baseball players and really good representatives in the community. So much of who we are and have really helped, quite frankly, shape our brand into what it is and what we know today to be the Minnesota Twins. And so taking that look back, honoring and paying homage to those traditional legacy players, looking at the youngsters coming up who are our amateur minor league divisions, and then also Town Ball, which Ann referenced, the Town Ball Tavern, really again trying to honor and pay tribute to how important this game is to communities throughout Twins territory, and that's kind of all what Town Ball the Tomball Tavern does. So you can go in, and if you live up in, you know, you name it, Ely, Minnesota, they've got a Tomball team, and you can see a picture of the team from 1973, if you will. But it's, I think it's one of the things that differentiates us from some of our other ballpark brethren, if you will. And it's a little bit of a funny story. When we were concepting the ballpark back in 2006, 2007, we really wanted to have a place where we could showcase all of our archival memorabilia, all of the great things that we had collected and been given over the years. And unfortunately, we went through this process called value engineering. Anyone know about value engineering?
Yes.
There's nothing valuable about that process. It's where you have to start cutting the budget, right? So initially we had SPECT, like a Hall of Fame museum type concept, on the property. And unfortunately, just as things started to shift and move around and we had to prioritize, that kind of fell off the drawing table. The good news is we decided that it's so important that we were in a position to display this memorabilia, continue to showcase and tell the story of how important our players in this game have been. We now kind of sprinkled all of those display cases and storylines and storyboards throughout the entire ballpark. So it actually is going to make it lemonade out of lemons, right? We took a what could have been a negative, tried to turn it into a positive, and it inured to the benefit of our fans because now everyone in the ballpark can enjoy it.
So a little more time, a couple more questions for Laura, and then we'll move on to some of the other people. But how many women do you see working in the front office of a major league franchise these days in your travels or in working with other teams? Or, you know, how common is it for a woman to be in the front office?
Well, the really good news, having been in the sports industry now for just over 20 years, I started when I was 12, I can tell you it's changed dramatically. And I think Cecilia is nodding her head. Leslie would probably agree. And I defer to some of them for some of the statistics. But back in 1991, I can tell you from a twins perspective, I could count on one hand the number of women in our front office. I will tell you today, woo-woo, more women working, actually. From a full-time perspective in the Twins front office. Baseball, Major League Baseball, from a league perspective, has made a huge commitment to ensure that we have appropriate and diverse representation, not just on the field of play, but in the front offices throughout baseball, which is great. But it's interesting to see, even when you take it outside of the context of simply baseball, when I was, again, first in this business back in the early 90s, I think at that time we had a woman in the National Football League in a pretty high capacity. Sarah, I forget her last name. Anyways, there really weren't very many women in the league levels in sports. Certainly not in baseball. And now you've got women running major sports marketing brands. Coca-Cola is run by a woman who actually kind of grew up in their system running their sports marketing division. So you've got women owning wrestling teams and franchises, and you've got women race car drivers. Thank goodness we still have to have women playing our game at the major league level.
Minor league first, and then major.
But it really has shifted exponentially in the last two decades, which is good to see. We still have a long way to go.
And day to day, you know, your title is impressive and has a lot of big words, but your office is at Target Field. What do you do on a daily basis when it comes to, you know, the business side of it, but how much interaction is there with the team and the players, and how much of a fan can you actually be when you're working around the team day in and day out?
You know, all of us, I think, in the front office love the game. You know, I don't think we'd work there if we didn't. As you know, baseball is a bulk sport. Sporting activities tends to be the longest season, so we put in some pretty long days. It's hard to work when you love what you do, and when you get to go to work at a ballpark every day, not too tough. And again, nothing I ever take for granted. You know, I have oversight, if you will, for all the revenue-generating sides of the business. So the number one revenue generating, you know, operating income is ticket revenue. So we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we sell tickets and group tickets and single game tickets and hospitality and suites and so forth. The partnership side, the sponsorships, again, we have great partners, long tenured sponsors. Dairy Queen has been with us more years than I think I even know, 25 years plus, which again, I think speaks to the strength of our brand from a consumer marketing perspective. We are fans. I tend to stay out of the press box. No offense to our media brethren here in the room. But you know, there you have to kind of keep that poker face and not get up and cheer and shout and Willingham gets over the outfield wall fence. If I'm out in the stands and in the concourses, which I really love to be, then I can be, you know, much more cheerleading and maybe kick a few shins when they're not doing so well, like yesterday, we took quite the drubbing. But, you know, it's interesting. I think when I first got into this business, again, I knew nothing about the business of baseball, but I was passionate about business and how things work. And I haven't fortunately lost that love of the game, having been on the business side, because you do see things through a little bit different lens than you do if you're sitting in the seats having a hot dog and eating peanuts. It's challenging, but I will tell you, I wouldn't trade it for a minute. Wouldn't trade it for a minute.
So we can open up some questions too. If there's some questions that are coming to mind, just feel free and run up to that microphone. You know, so that's a little perspective on what it's like to work in the front office. You've heard from you know, Dorothy about writing about the game and telling stories. Cecilia, you run a blog, and one of the longest running sites on the internet. Write it down, people, in case you don't know about it. It is called Why I Like Baseball. What is kind of, you may have a question. I may just interrupt myself and get to our friend over here, who's looking very inquisitive. What would be your question? I'll continue my question here, but I don't want to stand here.
Most people.
There you go. You are on. Where? What is your name and where are you from?
My name is Barry Deutsch. I'm from Carl Springs, Florida, and I've never been called inquisitive.
Okay, and who
Yes. Well, my question is, this, everybody's background is really superior. My question is, what's happening tomorrow to advance women in baseball? I mean, I'm really interested in two slots in particular. One, because she's a good friend. I'm interested in umpires. And I'm also interested in official scorers. I'd like to know why there aren't more women in the non-playing roles, other than the novels, other than in the front office of the Minnesota Twins at the beautiful Target Field and so on, which we heard about a lot today. But where are the umpires? Where are the official scorers? Where are the coaches? Where are the managers? I see women running around basketball courts, blowing whistles and wearing striped shirts. Why don't I see women in blue in baseball?
Well, we know that there are some, right, Leslie?
There certainly, and you're right, it was one of the big questions, and of course on the umpiring side, Perry is referring to currently is Perry Barber. Perry has been in the umpiring world for many years, certainly not alone in the history of that, but it's always very much a singular kind of operation here, particularly in the United States. Interestingly enough, on that side of things, if you look to our north, in Canada, there's a much, much different story. And there are a significant number of female umpires, much more organized set of playing leagues, whole thing on the Canadian side, to the point on the umpiring side, even where there is a school for female umpires. And so they have an entirely different approach and always have on that particular side of things. On the official scores, there are a few, but not many. There never have been. When you look beyond certainly the amateur level to the managing side of things, again, you don't see much, and certainly not currently in that particular score. From my perspective, and others can add, one of the things that I think accounts for some of that, unfortunately, is the history of the game itself in this country. When you think about the history of the game itself, starting as very much a manly sport, it was referred to that way. It was very much a sense that it was something that was going to provide opportunities for men to be out and show that manly side of themselves to, and baseball was very much a part of that kind of idea. And when you look at some of the very early women's baseball teams in the 19th century with the idea that, you know, they were allowed to play, but if they were going to play, they had to play where they couldn't be seen, they had to play where nothing was going to get broken, and they didn't mean windows and things like that, that really meant, you know, it was a dangerous game, and if a woman got hurt, that was going to put an end to it. The idea that women playing and participating in the game at any level was going to be detrimental to them, to not just their health, but also their intellect, because the general belief was that if women were too strenuous, it would affect their ability to think and all of those kinds of things. And that very much was an attitude for a long time. Softball comes along, and of course softball was not initially created for women. And yet that's what everybody thinks. Softball was originally created for men. It was designed that way, it was set up that way, but it was set up with the idea that it was going to be something that was the easier an opportunity for, and the original idea was for men, as they got a little older, weren't necessarily able to continue to compete on it, and it was an indoor game as well. And so, but the idea, if you think about that, that it then gradually became the acceptable alternative for women, because it was considered to be lesser, all levels, something that was done outside, but it was an indoor game to keep people in shape. Well, in the off season, it was considered for men of an older age. It was even called, at one time, it wasn't called softball, it was called kittenball, and a variety of other names. And so you can see the kind of idea. So when you think about that aspect of it, that's been a very hard thing to overcome. And then certainly the idea that women don't understand sports in general, and baseball in particular, and certainly that was something you were referring to earlier, Dorothy, that has to be overcome. And when you look at the umpiring side of things, that's certainly the control of the game, the idea, and a few women who have played that role, you can think about certainly Mary Barber today, Pam Postuma, Bernice Guerra, there's a variety of names out there. Stories that they will tell you, the most common thing they hear, you know, is what are you doing out here? You need to go home, back to the kitchen, where you belong, those kinds of things. And certainly umpires get that kind of abuse all the time. But I think one of the greatest explanations is just overcoming the history of the game itself and how people have viewed the game and getting people past that point. When Dorothy was referring earlier to one of the players in the 50s, woman, got a contract and everything. The response, you know, of George Trautman was, over my dead body, will this happen? And a woman is going to play at this level. And so that was kind of the attitude, the approach. And you even get that still today with women that are playing and the idea. And so in answer to another part of your question, Mary, I think it's also on the coaching side, the managerial side, it's roll-ons that aren't there for women to be able to see that opportunity, to look to that. I mean, I think you'd say that even in the front office, thinking that that's an opportunity for me if you never see anybody doing that. And so from my perspective, that I think is a couple of the reasons why you don't see that happening. And I think there's a harder answer to the second part of your question about what's being done, but I'm going to let some others answer if you've got something else.
I'd just like to add about Pam Postuma, the umpire. If you've ever read her autobiography, you know one reason why there aren't a lot of women umpires. How would you like to get up and do your job and be spat in the face with a full of tobacco juice? I mean, she had not just people saying you were going home. She was really bullied. Of course, bullying is really recognized now, but it wasn't then. You just had to put up with it. And it was a special kind of bullying for women, but they really sit and did vulgar things and disgusting things. And then she put up with that for about 11 or 12 years. She was an umpire for a long time. But then she was fired. I think she might still be playing if she wasn't fired. They decided she just wasn't good enough after all that time. But the person named Perry Barber that you mentioned, I think she's going to stick it out. She's a very good umpire, and I'm hoping that she will manage to get up to the major.
She umpired today at PNC Park.
Perry did?
She did, but it wasn't the Pirates. It was some professional
or something. The problem with Perry is that she's a single figure, and we can hope if she makes the major leagues that she will inspire a new generation of girls to go, that want to be umpires, and the visualization even that people make an umpire will start to change. Part of the problem is that we don't have women going through umpire school right now. At the Sabre Convention 10 years ago, actually, we had an umpires panel. It was my first Sabre Convention, and these guys talked about how it's a very tough life, and two umpires get together as partners, and they have to travel the whole minor league season together, and they're like cops or partners, They spend all their time together, and this and that, and they have to be very close, and they have to support each other, and I said, does that stack the deck against female umpires? And they said, well, no, of course not, but of course it does. It's like, and it never occurred to them that, if you had a male and a female umpire traveling together, like, somehow the universe would end, So we don't have enough women coming into the talent pool, even, for us to be able to say. And it's not necessarily about the ability to call the game or the knowledge of the game or anything. I mean, if you read the book As They See Them, a great, great book on umpires, actually that I bought at a Sabre Convention also. One of the points made in that book, the writer went and talked to lots and lots and lots of major league players, coaches, so forth, and he said to all of them, what's the most important thing about an umpire? What's their most important quality? What's their most important skill? And he thought they would say accuracy. Not a single one. Every single one said how authoritative they are. The most important thing that an umpire does is keep control of the game. As if major league players would just run wild like animals and claw each other or something if the umpire weren't standing up there as the authority figure, which I thought was interesting. And that's very, and he was surprised. He's like, I really thought they would say, eyesight, how accurate their calls are. And it was like the integrity of their spirit and their authoritativeness, which was what they wanted in an umpire. That's what Major League Baseball sees sociologically as the need for the umpire. And a lot of guys just won't listen to what a woman says. That's the mountain that we have to climb.
Interestingly, on the umpire in school, in the number of times that Perry's been there and the lack of other females that attend, and she talks about it to people, and women are surprised to even think that, and she's surprised to discover how many of them don't realize that this is something that they could do, and that there's an opportunity out there for them. She also told me a couple weeks ago when I was talking to her that a couple of the new ballparks have putting in new locker rooms and are including a locker room for female umpires. And she asked them, well, what are you doing with it in the meantime, since there are, and they're using them as storage space.
Right.
Until the day comes when they might need them.
Yeah, but at least they're building them.
That was her comment.
So I can tell you about the Metrodome. Again, we played in the football stadium, corner of the football stadium. We were an afterthought. There were no locker room facilities for women. Zero.
Target Field has that.
Yeah. So.
There you go. Well, look at our line. Get in line. Welcome, K-Stater. Go Wildcats. Yes. What is your name and where are you from?
My name is Dr. Rod Merkel, and I'm from Bloomington, Illinois. But I lived in Kansas when you were on the air in Kansas City.
Wow.
So
how about that?
I thought you looked familiar. I don't know.
Yeah.
You said the joint user, Sweeney, and all those guys.
Yeah.
We'll talk after that.
Very good.
Forget that. My question, I know this could become a broad-based question, but I'm a professor, and I have a sports management program in my college, and I have several, like the professor from Kent State pointed out, in her classes, my demographics of my classes have changed dramatically over the years. They used to be mostly all male. Now this is about 50-50 in my college. Anyhow, the question I have, with the wide array of experience on the panel, what specific suggestions could you guys give my female students of how they can get into the baseball industry. Is it through internships? Is it through, you're there, you're in the baseball industry. What can I share with my students in my fall sports management class when we talk about baseball? Of course, I love baseball. That's one of the key topics that I focus on, sports management. And the people are like, well, that's the guys that play baseball. What are we girls? And there are girls in that class where I've heard them, I go out and about baseball, and most of the guys do. And they want to stay in baseball. Tell me what they can do as they continue their education and go on careers. I wish all of you would briefly address that. I know there's other guys right here in the West, but.
I'll lead off. First of all, I think a couple of things, sir. I think it's important, as is reflected by, I think, this panel in and of itself. It's not necessarily all just about working for a team. Maybe that's the big end goal. But I will tell you, there are only 30 baseball teams, football teams, hockey teams, whatever. And there's only 29 other people that have a job, pretty much, that I have. Very little attrition. So I would say, you know what, focus on your studies, get as broad base of experience as you can. Go out and spend time on the community affairs side. Go out and work with a physical therapist, because that's a whole nother way into the world of sport. You have Ann on the broadcast media side. Cecilia, player, media, journalist, right? Author, teacher, front office. I think there's a myriad of opportunities, if you will, to get close to the game, any game, basketball, baseball, you name it. I don't know, if the goal is to get to work for a team, I always look for really well-rounded individuals. How did they do in school? Did they engage in volunteer activities? Did they volunteer for a local baseball team? Whatever, selling hot dogs at the town ballpark. I think if they can put themselves in a position to capitalize on some of the internships, again, very limited, in their scope, which is challenging, but get as much experience in and around the game.
I have to agree. Don't just focus on working for a team. I just had a Saber intern in my office. I wrote Saber publications from my home office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I had a Boston University student, a female student, who had gone there and majored in business, took one class in statistics, and suddenly realized that there was a future for her in baseball analysis. And she quit her major in business and switched to majoring in statistics so that she can analyze baseball statistics, and came to work for me. And what she went for me was book publishing, really. I mean, you know, so yes, the books we publish are about baseball, but so she got, and she's right now working this summer for the Charleston River Dogs, you know. So she took off for the summer, you know, she's a go-getter. And I'm 100% sure that if she wants to work for a team in some number of years, she will find a way to do it. But yeah, there are internships in the related industries of baseball. And I see in the media especially, there's much less resistance than there once was. I mean, when I first joined a group called AWSM, the Association for Women in Sports Media, AWSM, most of the newsletter and, you know, so forth was sort of about how hard it was. And now there's much, much more sort of, you know, talking about our successes and mentoring the, you know, sort of whole groups of people coming up and working for media organizations and so forth and so on, and sort of like that, that I don't say that has been kicked down, but it's, you know, it's much more open to, you know, there's much more diversity in the media overall, also ethnically, also, you know, so forth. So there's much more opportunity, and then, you know, if you can't do that, make your own opportunity. You know, in the 90s, I started a blog because just trying to get freelance gigs working for other people was, you know, was tough. I mean, I did write for Yankees Magazine, I did write for, you know, what I could find. I said, well, I'll start my own thing and see how that goes. And it turned into, you know, sort of a thing of its own. So, you know, that kind of stuff. There, sports has so much involved in it that's not just about the game itself. There's training, healing, you know, healing arts, one like that is sort of one of the acceptable things for women to study, you know, that sort of thing. There's officiating, you know. So yeah, I would say help people be creative and don't give up.
I was just going to share from my perspective, being in the media, more women than ever are part of the media. When I got hired in the late 90s, it was a novelty to have a woman in the sports department. Let's stick around on the weekend. That's kind of good for ratings. Isn't that sweet? They have a woman there doing sports. Now, I always got the reaction, and you know sports? Oh my gosh, you know? Like, don't let the blonde hair fool you. You know, I actually know stuff. But I will tell you, that was some time ago, but I fight that every single time I open my mouth. Let's see what she knows, because there are some bad eggs that spoil the bunch that have not exactly given women in sports broadcasting a very good name, and we fight that every single day. And there are women coming through high school and growing up watching these women thinking, maybe that's my ticket to this, this, or this, and don't generally have good intentions for a career on the side of the business. But there, I think you can weed them out rather quickly when I mentor a young woman, when you see their passion or you understand their background, that they're a daughter of a football coach, and their brother was the high school pitcher. I mean, I think you can determine that passion pretty easily, just like it was for me. And, you know, it takes a lot of work. One thing none of these women have mentioned, and neither have I, this is a highly competitive industry. Working in sports in general is pretty cool and pretty desired, whether you're a man or a woman. And so these jobs are highly coveted. Laura mentioned there are 32 NFL franchises. There are three women in Minneapolis-St. Paul media market that cover sports. This is market 15 in the country. New York, of course, being one, LA being two. This is the 15th biggest media market with four major sports franchises and a regional sports network. And there are three women that on television covering sports in this market. That's not very many. That's three jobs. I always told them, I'm never coming back home. I'm never going to get a job there. Do the math. Hello, I'm not going to get a job there. I'm going to be in St. Louis the rest of my life. I'm not coming home, Mom. She couldn't understand. Like, well, just get a job here in between. Just call them up. It's a highly competitive industry. And for young women today, you know what? Show that passion early. It doesn't hurt to pick up the phone. I mean, I still challenge myself to pick up the phone. And when someone shows interest in your job, they want to share that with you. I'm sure you find that too, Laura, and with your teachings and with your blog. If they find a passion, it's not too early to start in high school to shadow and to, you know, really find out. Because I'll tell you, in college, they don't tell you all the jobs that are available. No one tells you that you can do this, this, and this. And with community relations side and all those kinds of things in college. So I would just direct women to explore things early and make phone calls and do as many internships as you can. If you're a baseball person, do an internship in sport, in football, because you'll find out quickly that I'm a baseball person. So anyway, that's a little media perspective over here. Let's get on to our rolling line.
Can I add something,
Anne? Yes.
I'd like to add that I think my next publication may help your students. I'm writing a history of baseball, women in baseball, for young people as an e-book. It'll be a YA, it'll be a young adult book. And this will reveal to them that women have been involved in baseball history since the beginning. They have no notion of that. They don't realize it. They don't realize that there have been women heroes, wonderful players, people who have been involved in the back office or front office, as they call it now, for many years. And maybe if that's introduced to the schools and colleges, they'll realize that they too might have a future in baseball.
Just to add something to it, because I would reiterate everything that everybody said, the internship type can't, but the real key, I think, is the thinking broadly and thinking beyond the, but I would also add something that Ann just kind of touched upon, and that is doing the research and encouraging them to know sort of the history of the sport in world, whether it's baseball or otherwise, but in this case, as to who's out there and who has been involved. It's sometimes helpful to be able to point out to people that, you know, it hasn't been done before, and here are some success stories. So knowing some of that, but also doing the research and encouraging them to do that, to find somebody that they can reach out to, who can mentor them, who can provide those opportunities, because I think that's the missing piece a lot of times. You don't see, you don't understand that there are people out there in those various places, and that's something that they can all do on a regular basis to look at and find the Laura Nays and others who are out there in various aspects, and reach out and work to reach out or know something about them so they can see what path did they follow, how did they get there, what did they do to get where they are. And I think that's an important part we sometimes miss.
Okay,
unfortunately, the women's professional leagues, I know especially in soccer, have struggled. With that being said, do you think it's more likely that there'll be another league of their own, if you will, or that a woman will actually play for a major league team? And what would you rather say?
Well, interestingly, there's a great deal of women's baseball going on right now, both in a league setting and as individual teams, and certainly the Pawtucket Slater Reds are a good example of that.
I have the stats.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is what it is on leading to is something that many people are not aware of. Next 2 months in August, the Women's World Cup is going to be being played in Edmonton, and it's been played since 2005, 2006, and of course that doesn't involve just the United States team, but it involves they're up to now 16 different countries participating in that opportunity, and so that seems to be the direction that is growing. If you talk to women who currently play in the game, you get a varied reaction. Some of them will tell you that it's likely that a woman will find her way through the minor league, and others will say that's really not what they're looking for. It's simply the opportunity to play, and to play at the highest level they can, and for them, that highest level is against other women, and to have that be accepted at the same level that men's baseball is. But one of the concerns is always, it'll never be quite accepted unless you can play with the men, because it'll always be seen as a lesser equivalent. And so
I like to equate it with speed skating. You know, the speed skating is one of these sports that's never going to be a professional sport. It's always, you know, or might not be. It's always going to be at the amateur level. You see it in the Olympics, and there's men's speed skating, and there's women's speed skating, and they all have massive thighs. it's one of these, and that's where the action of the women's game is in the amateur level. The IBAF, who run men's amateur baseball tournaments around the world, are the ones who are the sponsoring, overseeing organization for the Women's World Cup. The teams that are going to be in this year: Canada, Japan, USA, Netherlands, Venezuela, Cuba, Australia, and Chinese Taipei are the eight finalist teams. But there are more teams feeding into that. You know, we're trying to get in. It is in Edmonton, which I realize is 1,200 miles from here, but that's close compared to it was in Venezuela in 2010. That might be a little far for some of you to go. So while it's in North America, please take the opportunity if you can to go and see this. It's August 10th through the 19th. It's, an elimination tournament, so there's potentially many games. And if historians are not writing down what happens at these games, the information is lost. USA Baseball, which is the organization that organizes the women's team that we send to play these other countries, just like they used to organize the Olympic teams, and now they're Olympic baseball, that's another story. They're too busy to actually be really compiling the story. We were lucky to get box scores out of them for the 2010, some of the players' names are spelled wrong in it. So fortunately the close players are still living, and we can go to them and be like, is that how your name is spelled? And we're like, no. That sorts of thing. So historians, now is your chance. History is being made now. Go and be writing and covering this sort of thing, because the major media is not going to be doing it.
But I think that's where there's an opportunity as well. We've talked role modeling, we've talked mentoring, we've talked about putting ourselves out there right in the position to succeed. Our media brethren, let's start the groundswell. Why isn't there more coverage? And why don't we have a network covering that final championship game? You know what I mean? We've got to speak up. That's why we were given voices. And that's how
you have to demand it. You have to say, couldn't ESPN 8 or whatever be playing it? Where is the streaming video from these games, et cetera? And I know it's expensive, but,
They can do it for curling.
Right.
Sorry. We can sure say that for women playing baseball.
Right, exactly.
In Edmonton.
Sir, you are next. Who are you and where are you from?
Tom Heisman, First Set, New York. Just to put the one on Pam Poston and then a question. Pam Poston had a champion in the National League. His name was Bart Giamatti. And Bart Giamatti's, one of his affirmative action plans was to bring women into umpiring. Pam Poston did umpire a major league game at Double A Field. It was a Hall of Fame game. exhibition, and it was about the fourth inning before either one of those teams realized that they had a woman behind the plate calling balls and strikes. I was there. That was 1988.
Say the best umpire is invisible, right?
And had Bart Giamatti lived, I firmly believe that there would be women umpires in professional baseball. But when we lost him in September of 1989, that plan went down the drain. He was then commissioner, and we were on our way to having Pam Bosman in the major leagues, but that was, that all went with Bart.
What's interesting that Bud Selig has a sort of affirmative action plan of his own, and I hear you're laughing, I know. The problem is that...
I'm using an old term that I realize.
Yes, but the problem is that... So Selig has done some very progressive things in the game, including initiatives to have more women owned businesses, providing concessions, you know, the jerseys and t-shirts that are designed and made, and, you know, you can put in a bid to have a, you know, to be an official provider of, you know, whatever, for a major league team, whoever makes the keychains, right, you know, so forth and so on. He put in a whole initiative to have more women-owned businesses in that, involved in that, so forth. But as far as baseball on the field goes, I mean, their idea was separate but equal, and they supported the women's professional or semi-professional, whatever, with softball league as, like, the, well, that's our, you know, our nod toward women's athletics.
Well, even Little League has done that. I mean, that's the battle you're fighting against on that.
Right.
That's Little League's alternative when they got trouble.
And actually, I'm not speaking for Sabre here. I'm speaking my own personal opinion here, is that it's a ploy, as far as I'm concerned, to keep women separate and keep them from entering the major league field.
Yeah, I see. We're in sort of a separate but equal stage, maybe, in the evolution of this and the gender equality. I think also within the affirmative action framework and theory, one of the things that you women need to do when you are in a position to do it, if you can get in that position, is to hire other women. And until you get into the positions where you can make those decisions and pick out qualified women, that's going to be really the next step. That's how you will crack the all-male.
The old girl network.
Not the players. not the players. But there are studies that show that there was some mythology out there that women would not hire other women. And a recent study published indicates that that's no longer the case, so much the case that it's changing in the society, and I think it'll change in baseball.
David Paulson, Columbia, Maryland. I'm on the Save the Oral History Committee. A couple of years, about 4 years ago, I had the opportunity to interview the head groundskeeper for the Baltimore Orioles, who is a woman. And I asked her if there's any other women, and she said there was one other in the major, so there were two for that occupation. Then about 3 weeks ago, I interviewed Harolyn Cardoza, who is the assistant to Mike Rizzo, the general manager of the Washington Nationals. She says that every team has an assistant to the general manager, and a good number of them are women. So,
that's true.
It's over. It's almost three quarters of them now.
All right, let's continue our discussion. Who are you, and where are you from?
Seamus Carney from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Welcome.
I'm here to push the envelope a little bit more, not on the separate but equal. Actually, I'm looking for in terms of equality. I believe that women are not going to make any impact whatsoever on baseball until the population of women and girls who are involved in baseball dramatically increases. And I believe that the single largest impediment to preventing that from happening is the public school board's decisions to funnel girls into softball. I believe that every woman in America should start screaming and yelling and making that decision by the local public school boards to not have a baseball team for girls is holding women back from making multi-million dollar contracts in major
leagues. It's such true. What's
that, Seamus? And then I can't tell who you're wearing on your hat there from here.
This is a Pawtucket Los Angeles.
All right. Pawtucket is in the house.
It is.
Welcome. Who are you?
Ty Waterman.
All right, Ty.
I'm in Attleboro, Mass. Worked in Boston. Wrote a book a while back, which is hopefully going to be published fairly soon. I had a chance to in this book on the 62S to talk to Felix Mantilla, the player that talked with quite a few different things. I said, Felix, what was the highlight of your experience with the 62S? And he said, I wanted to go into the restaurant in Florida during spring training, and I did. And the owner told me I had to leave because I was black. My owner confronted the restaurant owner and said, my entire New York Mets team is going to boycott your restaurant, and they all walked out. That was Mrs. Joan Mason. She was a pioneer. She is a person that we should know an awful lot more about. And I was wondering if any of you would like to speak to Joan Mason and what she meant to baseball.
I actually just did a rather large presentation on Joan, and that some of you may have been at Hofstra University, just had a conference on the 50th anniversary of the Mets. And Joan Mason was topic of conversation because Joan Mason, as the owner of the Mets, one of the only female owners who didn't inherit the team, but actually bought it with her own money, which makes her one of the most unique female owners that we have, and was involved in all aspects of the operation from 1962 until her death in the later part of the 1970s, and was, from many of the players' standpoints, one of the highlights for all of them, at most opportunities, seen as the face of the New York Mets and the beloved grandmotherly figure, as many of them described her, sat in the stands. But even when she was away, when she went on vacation, when she was gone, she developed her own systems as ways to make sure that she was constantly in touch with the game. Whether it was one of her most common things that she did was to have her, she developed a system with her chauffeur, and he would go to the games and listen for her and then send the scores to her wherever she happened to be. She was often seen, she made a great deal of her money, of course, in the horse racing business. And she would attend a lot of the races, and you'd see her at the races watching her horse with the radio up to her ear, but she's listening to the Mets game to make sure that she knew what was happening. But one of the big things about Joan Mason was her ability to, while she thought it wasn't her place necessarily to get involved in the day-to-day operations of the team, that her job was the money. And she did also acknowledge that she wasn't sure that that would be what they wanted, meaning the rest of the band. I mean, for her to get involved, she didn't think she'd be taken too seriously, but where necessary, she was willing to step up, and that is one of many examples that you gave, Ty, of the kinds of things that she did to support her players, to make sure that they were treated. She saw them as family, and you don't let family get mistreated, is the way she believed, and whatever she had to do to make sure she was going to do. She was very involved in some of the contract signings. One of her greatest pleasures was making sure that the Mets brought back Willie Mays. That was a particular player that she had interest in and wanted to see brought back to. And so very, very important, talking about role models for women, and but one that most people don't know a great deal about. So there's lots you can say about Joan Mason. And there's actually a book that's going to be coming out probably within the year, being written by a gentleman by the name of Sam Cohen. He's been working with her family to tell the story of Joan Mason. So keep an eye out for that either later this year or early next year.
Step right up, young lady.
Yeah. My name is Claudia Peary. I'm a former president of the Society for American Baseball Research. And it's kind of weird that I was the only woman in line. Problem that Joan Mason had of inherited money to do such things. So, if any luck, that's going to happen. I wanted to just make some observations about many of the things that the panel had talked about in terms of role models. And of course, we're looking at a couple of great ones here in the media, but in the last 5 years, 60,000 journalists have lost jobs in both print and electronic journalism. There's a lot of online media, but to say that the compensation is embarrassing would be an understatement. So all I would also ask is, for those of you who might help show women the way in terms of trying to participate in media, make sure that they stand up for fair compensation, because there's kind of a sense out there now that, because anybody can put a blog up, and having read Cecilia's, you called it a blog, but not everybody can write the way she does, and not everybody can write as well as Claire Smith comes to mind. I'm a fairly well-known female sports writer, also African-American. At one point in my youth, I was the first black female sports writer in Virginia, probably the last, but during that period, there were some pretty decent pitchers on a team called the Richmond Braves. You might have heard of a few of them, Tom Glavine, you know, guys like that. So I spent a little time hanging around them a bit, and also had the little bit of a mishap in the locker room where I walked down Ralph Garr naked. Details of my request. Another thing I also want to offer with some of the things that you guys talked about, and just to re-emphasize that we are all here in the service of the history of this game, is to make sure that you are doing what you can in your communities to support the efforts of whether it's women playing, whether there are women involved in baseball business. You know, one of the most powerful women in Major League Baseball is their design director, Ann Oshie, and I think she's been around for a while. If you have strong feelings about Teal, she's the person you need to speak to. So I think it's very important as a group of historians that we keep each other accountable and honest and make sure that, you know, we team up, whether it's, it shouldn't just be, you know, Sabres Women in Baseball Committee, though you're all welcome to join. Keeping track of the World Cup, keeping track of the efforts. I know there is some effort to attempt, I know, to reinstate both baseball and softball to the Olympics. And while I have somewhat mixed feelings about both of those things, I still think it's very important that as that goes on, we have everybody in this room, if you see something, as they say, say something. And also, the next group of people we need to work on is Little League. Because at a certain point, when a girl reaches a certain age, it's like, that's it, no more baseball for you. And they get shunted off into softball with the assumption that that's the quote-unquote natural order of things.
Also with the assumption that softball and baseball are close enough as the same game. And of course, because that's all that was said.
Horseshoes and hangers, maybe, but I think not.
Yeah.
And I think it's extraordinarily important that, you know, we have more sort of Jupiter toes out there. Fascinating means nothing to you. You really do need to know your history.
I just like to interject the fall off is so dramatic that every time I quote the numbers, I think I'm getting them wrong. But I believe we have about 1 million girls playing Little League baseball right now, and then at the next level it drops to under 10,000, and at the next level it drops to hundreds.
Mere
hundreds. So yes, this is the level that we're talking about. That there are 1 million girls out there. That means that almost 1 million girls every year have to quit playing baseball in this country. So
yeah.
So you know what level we're talking about.
Right. And part of that fall off is also the school boards and parents not putting, because what they look at and see is, well, if they're going to go on. The scholarship dollars, there's none in baseball, so softball is the logical thing because they can get the scholarships to go to college and things like that. And
yeah,
so,
there's scholarship money in softball.
Right, but the fact that there's any, and there's absolutely none on the baseball side, except for, of course, you may be aware that we have two female baseball players playing at the college level right now. Gaz Baylor is one of them pitching, and Barbara, the second name just escaped me. Do you remember who it is? Well, there are two of them. It's terrible. I can't remember her name. Yes, thank you. Marty Sanatelli. They're both playing at the college level right now, and that's a first since Julie Croteau and Isla Borders. And so, but those kinds of things are things people don't know about. If you don't stand up and say, this is what's happening, it is possible, it can't be done, because a lot of times that's what it is. People think it can't be done. And it certainly can, but everybody has to step up. Justine Siegel is a perfect example. How long did it take her? You probably are aware of Justine. She's the one who has been doing, last year, got an opportunity to throw out the first pitch and throw batting practice for a number of teams. But that's as far as it went. It's batting practice. And that took her 20 years to be able to do that.
Just Justine, who also coached for a Mike Beck-owned independent league team in Massachusetts for a year, was an actual professional coach. She's one of the principals running this girls' baseball academy at the Dan Duquette Baseball Academy in Massachusetts. It's this July 15th through the 20th. It's $630 for a week-long overnight camp, girls aged 11 to 17. It's actually for girls and boys, but this is a specific flyer that they put out to try to get
that camp
for.
Yeah, this is its fifth year already, and most people don't know it's there. Well,
yeah, just to close my remarks, the one of the reasons that I specifically want to pick on Little League, just because it's fun, educational, and it makes me feel better, is when you look at what happened with women's soccer in this country, it didn't start really with the academic teams, because the best players don't play at school level. While it's going to be wonderful if kids can play at the public school level, most public schools are getting rid of the athletics and physical education right and left. And while I appreciate Seamus's utopian worldview and many other things about Mr. Kearney, I really think it has to start with the league. And I think that if more communities can put pressure, because the best players are playing in baseball in the same way that the travel and select soccer teams, Little League, is their equivalent.
And one of the greatest successes at the Little League level has been girls who have wanted to play and have run into barriers and then discovered that there are others who play and they can take those stories. And most successes come when they've stepped up with other stories to say, this community has this many players. And that's one of the things, again, that Justine's group has done, is to be able to provide those connections so that you can ask the people to stand up with you and say, we did it in our league, and it didn't kill the league. In fact, it enhanced it. It opened up opportunities that were never there before. And that's what Little League needs, is the pressure to be able to change it. Because in their view, it's a perfectly successful model to say, softball is working great, the baseball is working great here. And it's tough to stand up, it's something you said earlier, as one individual or two individuals. But there's a groundswell out there. And we've all said it many times, strength comes in numbers.
One more thing before I yield the mic to whoever else might want it. I'm going to ask Barbara Torres to stand up, please. Barbara wrote two books that should be in every home library. One is called She's on First. And she is selling copies of that here. And the other is Women at Play. And she also has some research notes from that book. And Barbara was one of the first visible authors to write a lot about women's baseball in history. And in some ways, probably, you know, had her place in the pantheon before we discovered how involved Dorothy was in what her husband had done. So
it is at least partly Barbara's fault that I played baseball. Because I was obsessed with baseball when I was younger, kind of fell out of it a little bit when I moved to New England, and the team I loved was distant for me. I'm a Yankees fan originally. And also the Red Sox were terrible at that point, so they weren't really, I didn't know that it was fun to follow the Red Sox when they're terrible. I know that now. We've been involved in 20 years. But I was just reading every book I could get my hands on when I first joined Sabre, you know, about 2000. Or so, and Winter Play was one of them, and I think it must have been a review of the book, or I can't remember what it was, but it was something about reading that book that spurred me to say, well, wait a second, I can't be the only one who's sitting at home going, yeah, I wish I had, you know, I wish I could go out and pick up that ball, and went to the internet and discovered that there were, in fact, women's leagues around it. It took me a couple more years before I, actually, then Justine Siegel is the one who said, have you looked at the Pawtucket Slaterettes? They're only an hour's drive from you, and you know, so forth. That's how me and the Slaterettes got together. I played 6 years in that league, so 5-6 years. So, you know, even I don't know my own stats, you see. So, you know, it is partly Barbara's fault, yes, that I learned to play second base. Thank you, Barbara.
Before we lose the audience, I know we're going to be wrapping up here in a second, I also just wanted to thank you, Claudia. That's good. We also have our Women in Baseball Committee for Sabre, and our research committee meeting is right after this panel. That was not by accident. And we're going to continue this conversation over in the Deer Room, which is right down the hall here. So come join us after this is over.
Do we want to just close with one final question? You want to, or two final questions? We have time for two more questions? Okay.
Just quickly.
Yeah.
John Monsonabe, Florida. I think Philip had put it on to forming a professional league like the WNBA using that model, or maybe a model like the Negro Leagues back in the 40s, where you go into a stadium occupied by a major league team and they haven't professional baseball that way.
There have been a couple of entrepreneurs who have kind of tried to start things like that, and none of them have lasted. The money isn't quite there. And it's not really even the talent pool isn't there.
No, Colorado Silver Bullets are a perfect example in the 90s. They were around for almost five seasons. And they certainly played in various stadiums when the teams weren't there. And it was a struggle. And they eventually, when the sponsorship of that team eventually went away, just as they were starting to really make a reputation for themselves, basically because they lost too much money trying to get that opportunity off the ground.
I saw the Silver Bullets once.
Right.
And my impression was that they're very talented. Just matching them against men, they match them against other.
Right. So there are women's track teams right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, that go around. There's actually, I think I have a list of some names here. The Chicago Pioneers, they're the New England Red Sox, or the New England Blue Sox. For a while, and I think they've changed their name. I've actually sort of lost track of exactly what they're doing.
They've changed it three times.
Yeah, but it's many of the same people involved. For a while, there was a four-team women's league playing that was sponsored by one of the men's independent teams, where then all four teams played at the same stadium, and they always played their game after the independent league team games on Saturdays and Sundays. And so people who paid to see the men's game could just stay to see sort of a doubleheader, whatnot like that. That whole independent league is now kind of in, whatever. So that franchise moved from Lynn to New Hampshire. Now the New Hampshire franchise is gone, so I don't know what's
there's happening. There's a Philadelphia team that plays. Probably the biggest league that currently is in operation is out in the California area. Mm-hmm. San Jose, et cetera. There's in terms of the size, the number of
California league for women right now is so big that they split into North and South. So now there's going to be a Northern California Women's League and a Southern California Women's League. There's the New York League is revitalized. They're having tryouts and whatnot, I think, right now. Whatnot like that. We also have the problem in the women's leagues that the season's fairly short because if you're going to pull from high school and college players, you have to wait until their season is over, and then you have to let them go right around August 15th so they can go back to whatever school they have commitments to and so forth. So we really you just get July and half of August. That's the women's baseball season.
On that note, let's finish it up in style here. Who are you? Where are you from? Okay.
So are you familiar with Yuri Yoshida, who pitches for Hawaii? Alright, so she's not the typical baseball player when you look at it. She's small, she's Asian, she's a sidearmer, she's a knuckleball pitcher. Mm-hmm. So how does she get over this kind of gimmick theme to get out of an independent league and into an affiliated team?
Someone's got to want to take a chance. Is what it is. Someone's got to say, we're so desperate for pitching, and we think it would be a good PR move that this will be a fit here, and she'll, maybe they think there'll be community support, but it's got to be, a bunch of things are going to have to come together all at once.
Well, on that note, we are out of time here, and our women in baseball. Dorothy and Cecilia and Leslie, and thanks for coming and enjoy Minneapolis, enjoy the Target Field, and enjoy the rest of your convention. Thank you. We are available for questions. We are taking questions.